Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. Lauren Milan is a change agent committed to diversity, innovation, equity, and inclusion. She's an award-winning marketer, prolific investor, advisor, entrepreneur, and board member with a multi-hyphenate career spanning over 15 years. She has advised and invested in over 40 startups, and her portfolio represents over $5 billion in market capitalization. She's the founder and CEO of LMB Group, a strategic marketing and advisory company partnering with brands like CoverGirl. But she's also the CEO and board director of social startup Digital Undivided. Lauren was the first Black woman to start an early stage venture capital fund as a founding partner and managing director at Lauren was the first Black woman to start an early stage venture capital fund as a founding partner and managing director at Gen Y Capital Partners. But this is coming from someone who at age 19 became the youngest winery owner in the country, co-founding the internationally recognized Sugar Leaf Vineyards. Lauren, there is no stopping you. You're also a lifestyle expert. You've been on the Emmy Award-winning Tamron Hall Show, previously co-starred on Oxygen's Quit Your Day Job, and you're also the author of the best-selling book, The Path Redefined, Getting to the Top on Your Own Terms. So Lauren, welcome to Leave Your Mark. One of the things that you said in one of your interviews is that you kind of have lived your life backwards. So in a way, I kind of want to do this interview a little bit backwards because there's so much that you're doing right now. And I know there's obviously amazing stories from your childhood and what got you here. But in a way, I think it will be interesting to kind of hear it in reverse. So I'm going to start with Digital Undivided because you seem so incredibly passionate about what you're doing. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about what you do.
I'm super passionate about the work that I do and the work that we're doing at Digital Undivided. Digital Undivided is the nation's leading nonprofit organization driving the global shift towards inclusive innovation and entrepreneurship for Black and Latina women. This is an organization that was founded more than 10 years ago. I was at the very first conference. It was called Focus 100. I was there as the keynote speaker. I judged the pitch competition. I mentored founders. And I got close to the organization then and watched it evolve and grow to respond to the needs of women of color and innovation and entrepreneurship. From 2017 to 2020, I was chair of our board of directors. And in the middle or the top of the pandemic and the racial reckoning, I was unanimously appointed as CEO from my fellow colleagues on the board. So that was a surprise to me, but a great honor and a privilege to be asked to step into the role of leading the organization during a time where not just the challenges were unprecedented, but the lack of solutions on how to navigate moving forward were also unprecedented. And that created an uproar and an uprising amongst women of color, people of color, a lot of communities, even amongst women of all races and ethnicities, to have more confidence in a variety of things, but most importantly, themselves. And so we've seen more people turn to entrepreneurship. We've seen more side hustles become successful. And I've spent now 2.5 years leading the organization as CEO, but it's also that this is who I am. I am a Black woman. I'm a Black mother. I'm an investor. I'm an advisor. I'm someone who's been in this space for a very long time. I started my first business at 18. I'm 37 today. So I'm 18 years, almost 20 in the game. And I have accomplished a lot, but it's been a lot of time. A lot of time has elapsed for me to be where I am today.
Well, you know where there hasn't been a lot of time? In the 2.5 years you've been CEO at Digital Undivided, you have guided the organization's 4x revenue growth from 1.2 million to 5 million, elevated its brand, and built 40+ Fortune 500 partnerships in 2.5 years. Like, what about your leadership can accomplish something that expansive in such a short time?
Hustle, grit, hard work. But I will say that I'm fortunate that the hard work has paid off for me in ways that I know hard work doesn't always guarantee us the opportunities that we want in the future. And I think right now I'm in this very unique position where a lot of the companies, the brands, the businesses that I have had as clients over the years, whether that's banks and credit card companies, consulting companies, retailers, clothing brands, what have you, that know me well and that I have a strong rapport with, who believe in what I do, who have had enough time to observe and engage with me and how I work and how I drive results. And it's been fortuitous that I'm now leading this org and that I can introduce what I think are mutually beneficial opportunities to both sides, which has created an arm of partnerships for the organization that we never had before, which has contributed to not just 400% or 4x revenue growth, but also allowed us to grow our team, to scale our impact, to serve more founders, to do programs that we used to just do once a year on a rolling basis. You know, Digital Undivided used to be a local organization. Now we are nationwide. And so all of these things, I think, have come together in a really synergistic and beautiful way where people know that I'm known for brand innovation and marketing and strategy, but there are also deeply rooted issues that are holding a lot of us back. It's like part passion project meets right opportunity meets the ability to mobilize my network towards what I think is critically important right now in this moment. So I think a lot of people have heard me talk about my love for Digital Undivided because of the way that it created space before the world knew it was a space that needed to be created.
You know, change agents are sometimes not well received because a lot of times companies especially will say, we want change, we want to evolve, but actually no one wants to change at all. How do you institute change in an organization like that? Like, you have consulted so many different companies from many different perspectives, but when you approach a project where you're like, okay, this shit is getting turned around, like, how do you go in and create a space where people are not going to have their backs up, but people are going to be like, okay, let's open our minds to this?
It was years ago, I was going to go work at Viacom for Bob Bakish and a guy that was then there named Sean Moran. And they wanted me to like help run this whole alternative marketing solutions group for all of Viacom. And the head of HR, who had recruited me for the role, said that I was the most respectful disruptor they'd ever seen. And I was like, that's interesting. So I think that might be it, because when that was said to me, it was something that stuck with me, like, respectful disruptor. Why does disruption have to be seen as disrespect? I didn't even realize that like disruption was seen as so negative, right? So there's that. But I also think that there is a skill to being forward-thinking, disruptive, innovative, yet pragmatic. And I think that a lot of people who are labeled change agents, they have an agenda, and the agenda is often the same no matter where they go, right? If you have a change agent that says, I want equal opportunity for X people, they're running around to any and everyone that will listen to them with the very same narrative. I think what makes me different is because I've been a multi-hyphenate, I have a variety of experiences, lived experiences, professional experiences, cultural experiences. I've lived all over the world. I speak 3 languages, you know, a lot of different perspectives that can be valuable. And therefore, the people who see me as a change agent, don't get a copy paste of what someone else might be getting. And I listen intently and intentionally so that whatever it is that I am recommending actually makes sense, as opposed to them sitting there going, did you even hear what we just said? That doesn't work with this company. That doesn't work with our moonshot goals. That doesn't work with our org chart, or we're not doing that. It's not in alignment with our company values or company statements or anything. So I do think that there is a skill to wanting more and like wanting to raise the bar, wanting to broaden the aperture, wanting to disrupt, wanting to innovate, wanting to game change and shape shift and whatever the heck you want to call it. But I think when people feel as though that is coming from an informed place, that they've been listened and respected as part of that process, I think it is received in a very different way. So I don't have this experience of anyone ever going, oh, Lauren, ooh, you're coming up. That doesn't, no, because what I'm suggesting is based upon what you've asked me to come in and do and a reflection of what I am seeing and hearing. And so if you don't like what I'm playing back to you, then you have a problem that I didn't create.
Oh my God, that was so well said. Love that answer. From the perspective of investments, I mean, you are a highly skilled investor. What are some non-negotiable things that you look for when you're analyzing where you might invest?
It depends. It's always the founder. It is always the person who's going to lead the business every day of the week, because that's the person I have to trust to navigate the problems, the issues, the highs, the lows, hire the right people, make the right decisions, take the right risks. So I'm always looking at the elements of a founder's character. That matters more to me than almost anything else. I think a lot can be learned, can be taught. And I think a lot cannot be learned and absolutely cannot be taught. And so I invest based upon the integrity of the founder. And integrity can be credibility, track record, experiences, vision, proof points towards the vision, velocity towards their beta, the impressiveness of their team. Like, how impressive is their team to me? Do they have a board? Do they have a sounding board, official or unofficial? Are they resourceful? These are the key things that I consider before making an investment.
Do you think it's essential for a founder to be front and center of their company publicly? Or do you think, like, if someone is more of an introvert and is super uncomfortable being sort of that face, can they still succeed today?
Absolutely. I think it's new that founders are like the face of the business. This is a whole new Willy Wonka chocolate factory. Like, we haven't seen this before. Normally it was, you know, and everyone wanted to work for the corporation. It was blue chip. It was this, it was that. And that was the notch in your belt, or that was the stamp of credibility that you wanted, that you often needed to get ahead. That's changing. And we are finding that founders are expected to be subject matter experts. We're finding that subject matter experts are influential in their field. We're finding that that influence attracts investment, attracts opportunity, attracts partnerships. And I think that is beginning to become the winning recipe when we're looking at the future of blank, any industry, future of food, future of, I just invested in another company in the food space this week that I'm super excited about. And all but maybe five of the founders in my portfolio are very front-facing. That doesn't mean that they're public, but it might be that they are front-facing to their industry. It might be that they're front-facing to the trade. It might be that they are front-facing to their sales team. But the role of leadership, CEO, co-founder is no longer just behind a screen, behind a computer.
I would agree with that. Let's shift a little bit to the idea of storytelling, which I do think goes hand in hand with, you know, I'm sure like the companies you invest in have powerful missions, powerful stories, and know how to tell their story as well. In today's world where there's so much noise and there's so much competition and no one has attention span more than like 3 seconds, what do you think makes a powerful story today?
I think the most transformative powerful, compelling messages right now. I think it is stakeholder storytelling at the end of the day. And in some businesses, you know, your stakeholder is your customer, and some it's your investor, and others it's your partners or retailers, whatever it is. But storytelling the experience of the stakeholder is transformative. It's compelling for them, but it's compelling for all the people that you don't already serve who can also join you as additional stakeholders. And I think right now, you know, whether I'm advising or sitting on boards or have as clients publicly traded companies that are concerned about ESG or brand narrative or brand perception, at the end of the day, who are they afraid of? They're afraid of, or they're concerned about, the response or the opinion of their stakeholders. That's it at the end of the day, because those are the people that matter to your leadership role. You get to keep your leadership role and what that looks like. And I think that for a lot of time, there was this assumed formula of success, which was the brand story. But if the brand or the company story does not chart back to who keeps that company going by way of investment or by way of purchase or purchase patterns or involvement, story might be great. People might like the story, but does the story make anyone move? And I think all stories are within the realm of marketing and brand advisory. Those stories are designed to make movement of some kind. You want someone to move to change their opinion. You want them to move to change their biases or their stereotype. You want them to move and get rid of certain assumptions. You want them to move and make a purchase, or you want them to buy more because something's going to be on sale, whatever it is. But I think for a long time, it was so focused, especially in brands, it was so focused on the brand. It was like this product, this beverage, this food, this, it does this. It's so great for you. It's like, okay, great. But you told me 50 million times that it's good for me and how many calories it has. So how about how great it is for somebody else, how it improves their life? And I think when we tell more of these stories that are often underappreciated to our stakeholders, though, they are afterthoughts that they didn't realize could be as powerful as they are. And we spend a lot of time, especially in marketing, digging and kind of searching for something that we've hired research firms and focus groups to compile and create, when we actually have a lot of those answers right in front of us. But we've taken a different path that's taken far more time, that hasn't been as responsive or authentic, to land at a very similar destination. And I mean, even in COVID, you see some of the most incredible commercials where like a whole bunch of user-generated content pieced together because it felt real. It was real. And therefore it was transformative, and it was telling the story of stakeholders in a lot of cases.
Your book, The Path Redefined. Did you redefine your own path, do you feel? Or do you feel that these are more learnings that you're conveying to other people? Like, how do you feel?
I can't stand it. Like, all of these life coaches and online coaches that popped up out of everywhere, bless their hearts that they can make a living online with Facebook and Instagram ads and getting people to like tap into their program and learn their next fandangle thing. But I don't believe in that. I don't believe in preaching something that you don't have experience in doing. I don't want to hear from you.
Totally.
No. You don't have an informed experience that's going to be helpful to me. Why am I going to you as a source of information if you don't have what I need? And so I absolutely redefined my own path. The Path Redefined is my story. It's my business memoir. It's my memoir. It's my life story, my life experience, starting at my lemonade stand as a little girl, all the way through to company number one, number two, number three, babies one and two, a horrific divorce, and learning to redefine a variety of things, learning to redefine my definition of success, redefine my definition of love and appreciation, redefining my definition of self-respect, redefining motherhood, redefining career, redefining success, redefining wealth, redefining getting to whatever goal we have in life. And yeah, it's my story of what worked for me. And I think, you know, the book came out in 2014 and the subtitle is Getting to the Top on Your Own Terms. That's something I've always believed was true. And in fact, I got the book deal in 2012 wrote it in the end of 2012, wrote it most all of 2015, came out in May of 2014 for college graduation. And that was before anyone in the world was saying, like, on your own terms. Like, I should have trademarked it. I'm a little silly there. I mean, I'm not silly, but man, everybody wants to get to the top on their own terms. I was saying that 8 years ago. In fact, I was saying it 10 years ago, but it hit the press 8 years ago in terms of a published book that could be in someone's hands. And I'm actually in the process of making another edition to the book.
Amazing.
I think that there's a lot there that's really important for men and women. I had so many men writing in going, oh my God, I understand my wife or my daughter, or my granddaughter, or like, I get it now. Or, you know, I understand their passion or why they're working in this industry or doing this or doing that. And, you know, I think the most important thing that I wanted people to learn from the path we defined is that you charting your path towards a life that feels and looks successful to you is not determined by anyone else other than yourself. And so the book is a memoir, my story on how I built and created three companies before 30 while a single mom. But it's also a series of questions and reminders to create your own blueprint for determining what the path you define looks like for you and what, you know, quote unquote, getting to the top on your own terms looks like for you. And I think that, you know, a lot of my life and career has been early. And I think the world wasn't totally ready for that from women. Like, we weren't that unapologetic 8 years ago, but we are certainly that unapologetic now. So I'm excited for the second edition and to see how it continues to arm and equip women who want more for their life and who feel uncomfortable being unapologetic about what they want. But I put a pin in it because I never see or hear men apologizing for the money they want to make, the careers they want to have, the successes that they're chasing.
Which is a great segue to your goals, right? And how goal-oriented you are. I read somewhere that you actually have them written down and you like review them and you really think through. And I really appreciate this mentality because I feel like lately everyone's sort of resigned to just status quo it a little bit. So I'd love to hear, and if you could share a little bit about your tactics for how you sort of define your goals and stay on point with them. I think that would be really helpful for people.
I had a conversation, and I think what you might've read was probably what I'm thinking, if it was like the Morning Brew Sidekick article. But I had this conversation with Damon John a couple of months ago, similar to this. And he was talking about how he reads his goals every night, leaves them by the side of his bed, and he reads them and reviews them. And he does it again in the morning. So it's the first thing he thinks about when he goes to sleep and the first thing he sees again in the morning. And I started doing that. And I was like, this is really interesting because I still write handwritten notes. I still keep a physical journal. I still post-it note and do a variety of kind of analog things. But I also am curious about, you know, digital interfaces and ways to like remind us of our goals and like chart them out. But at the end of the day, no system is going to make me achieve my goal. Like, I'm going to make myself achieve my goal. And I think having that front and center, what is most important, or what do you gravitate to more? And it's not so dissimilar from what I discovered in writing my book. It was like, I was more passionate about certain areas. I didn't even realize that my editing team was like, hey, you wrote about this in chapter 3. And then 5 months later, you wrote about it in chapter 13 or 14 or whatever it is. Maybe this should be its own chapter. Where like, you don't even realize thematically what you are most drawn to. And so I think being able to see and hear your goals, remind yourself of what they are. For me, it's been helpful to use Damon John's hack, so I'm not going to take credit for that, because it's allowed me to understand what I'm most excited or fired up to do on each day. And so some days I'll go, I have so many ideas towards that particular goal. And I can sit at the computer and just write for hours and like go from point A to close to point Z. Whereas there might be another day where I feel as though I can build out a strategy on something else that I might have been putting on the back burner or not prioritizing in the same way. So I think words have power, and the more we see them, the more we hear them, the more we embed them, the more we are able to know how we feel about them. And there are also some goals that I've taken off of my list as a result, because I'm like, is that a goal, Lauren? That's not a goal. That's baseline, right? And you know it's baseline, and you know you're not doing what's necessary. You need to go fix it. Like, stop masking it as a goal, right? Like, there's some things in life, getting up early. My husband is like, he's an early riser. Like, he played football. He's like 4:30 in the morning. I'm like, oh, is he getting 4:30 in the morning? He's an executive performance coach, and he does all things kind of personal training, nutrition, executive performance. And he's been a large part of my secret sauce in that respect, in terms of like getting my mind right, my body right, like my clarity, my focus. And so he's like, you said next level. You better start getting up earlier, because I don't know how you can do everything in the day that you can accomplish. Yeah, and I like wrote it down as a goal. And I'm like, is this a goal, or is this just some shit I need to do? You know what I mean? Like, I just need to get up earlier, go to bed earlier. It's not a goal. Stop like adding to the goal list, Lauren. And so there are some things that I take off of the list like that, where I'm like, that's not a goal. That's something that's totally doable as of like tomorrow. If I go to bed earlier and I make a couple of shifts. So I think reading them, seeing them, hearing them, embedding them will also shake out what your priorities are for you if you have difficulty in prioritizing. Like, you'll be drawn to something every day, every week, where you'll be like, that's just the thing. And I think without reviewing them on a frequent or daily, it doesn't have to be daily, but that's what I've started doing, without reviewing them on a frequent basis, everything's your goal.
Such good advice. Let's talk about the start of your day. So it's not 4:30, but you do start your day reading.
Not anymore. I changed.
What are you doing now? What? Don't tell me you're meditating. What are you doing?
No. So my husband caught me and he's like, Lauren, you start your day in the bed reading articles. You know, some are business, some are this, some are that. It's like a variety of health, blah, blah, blah. Some like are triggering the news, crime, terrible things, right? And he's like, you haven't even like honored yourself for the day. Like, your feet haven't even hit the floor. You haven't even like brushed your teeth yet. And you're like panicking about the world, or not, or just like my mind is somewhere else. Then all of a sudden you don't do something else because you've allowed whatever you read to take you down another rabbit hole. And so he posed a challenge to me, which was, don't touch my phone before 7 o'clock. Don't touch my phone for news before 7 o'clock. I can touch my phone for podcast and like positive reinforcement, positive messages, music, things like this, but like not touch my phone before 7 for like work-related emails and news. And that's been a game changer, because now I wake up at 5:30 and I stay in bed till like 5:45-ish. And then 5:45, I'm up. And then we're in the gym from 6 to 7. And at 7, I start my reading of whatever is going on in the wild and crazy world and business. But it also then allows me to be home in time for my kids to wake up. And I've actually started making them breakfast, because I miss doing these things. So by 8 o'clock, I've made them breakfast. I've worked out. I've read the news. I've done a couple of emails. I've taken them to school. I'm trying to learn to like fit in my post-workout shower before taking them to school, but that does require being up at like 5:15. So the shower happens when I come back from school, drop off, and then I'm able to still be showered and on Zooms by like 8:30, 8:15 or 9 o'clock, whatever it is. But I did switch it up a little bit, and it has been a game changer. And I also find, in terms of efficiency and goals, that I am much more efficient in reading these articles once I've gotten my workout in and I'm like, I'm on it and I'm rocking. It's like all of a sudden what took me an hour to lay in the bed to read, I'm doing in like 35 or 40 minutes, just because I'm already like going. So that's been a real game changer.
Interesting. I might have to steal that from you.
It's awesome. It's hard though. Like the first couple of weeks, I couldn't resist. I was like, come on, can I just look at page 6? And I was like, you know, can I have something?
Always page 6. Always page 6.
Well, I was like, do juicy things count? Like, can I just have some fun? And he's like, as you wish, but like, you know, there's going to be a pop-up, like, you know, something else is going to like, is going to be another article.
That is such a good point. Such a good point. So you're such a New York mentality, but you live in Puerto Rico now. Have you been able to slow down at all? Or are you just, you brought your New York with you and that's the end of it?
I brought my New York with me, but I'm learning. I want to embed more of the Puerto Rican Latina culture into my everyday life, because the emphasis on family time, on like the connective tissue of your immediate family nucleus is so powerful. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I've seen it in other areas of Latin America, but we're still in the US, right? So like, where else are people really putting their families? I can't describe it as well as I'd like to in the time that we have, but suffice it to say that, you know, here when we first moved, there were so many business people that I was introduced to. And they'd say, oh, I can't meet with you for like 6-7 weeks. I'm really busy. My schedule's packed. I was like, cool, no problem. Those same people would text me 2-3 weeks later. Hey, you free for drinks this week? I'm like, I thought you weren't available for like 7 or 8 weeks where we have our meeting like on the calendar already. They said, oh, no. I'm booked for meetings and I'm not booked for drinks.
That's so funny.
So for them, it's like there is a time that you're on and there is a very respectable time that you are off. And you are entitled and well within your right to enjoy your family, your friends, food, community, all of these things. So when you hear that in the Latin culture, even here in Puerto Rico, it's like, oh yeah, estoy lleno, mi agenda es lleno. Yeah, okay, it's lleno, like lleno is full, like my agenda is completely full. Yeah, okay, but it's full from 9 to 5 or 10 to 6. That's what that means. Whereas for me, that means I got a breakfast, a lunch, a dinner, a gala. I mean, when we were living in New York, I used to do sometimes 1 to 2 cocktails and a dinner, sometimes 2 dinners, sometimes a gala and a cocktail. Like, it was just so many things that now when I'm back, which is all the time, I just am like, oh gosh, this is a lot, you know? And it, and then the energy is a lot. It's like you get in, you know, an Uber or a taxi and just the horn honking, the anger, the yelling, the screaming. I'm like,
you don't need to remind me about it. You're not missing anything.
It's 8 o'clock. Why are you mad already? You know, like, come on.
They didn't follow your morning routine. That's why they're mad.
There
right?
you go.
Speaking of cocktail parties and events, you strike me as someone who probably was able to go to any of these events alone, not know a single person, be able to walk in that room, light it up, make great connections, go home for the night. Am I right?
You are right. I used to also go on vacation by myself when I was a single mom for like 8 years. And my mom was like, you're just going to go to Turks and Caicos by yourself? I'm like, if you'll watch the kids, yes, I will. Like, you know, if you won't watch the kids, no, I won't. But if you will, I will totally be there by myself. And my mom was like FaceTiming all day. Well, what are you doing by yourself on the beach? Enjoying the beach.
I'm fine.
Totally fine.
So what is your advice to people who literally would rather die then go to an event by themselves? And what are your tactics when you show up in that space? How do you get comfortable if you're not comfortable? And how do you make it worth your while?
Goodness. That's a good one. I think how do you make it worth your while is to do something that makes you feel uncomfortable because you don't know how you'll feel after you do it. And you don't know the outcomes of what that can create for you. I think the tip I would give is what scares you more? Meeting new people on your own in a room that's unfamiliar to you, or knowing that there's a room full of incredible people that you don't know because you didn't go into the room to meet them. Like, you take the choice, you make the decision. And I think relationships are transformative in every industry. So how are you meeting people? That was one of the biggest fears amongst women who came to me at the top of COVID. It's how and why I started my professional branding boot camp, my personal branding boot camp through my company Showed Up and Successful, specifically for women, because so many women were like, whoa, it's COVID. There's no events. How am I going to meet people? How am I going to get my next job? How is my boss going to like remember that, hey, me over here, bonus time or whatever? Because networking, FaceTime had become such a big component of life. If we're thinking about events and invitations, unless it's an invitation you don't want, if it's an invitation you decide you want, figure out what you need to feel comfortable in the room. And if you feel really uncomfortable, then I guess maybe you should get there first as opposed to later, because I find that the people who don't feel comfortable, like don't do crowds, then they get claustrophobic, then they're overwhelmed, then they don't know who to talk to. They don't know who, where, what. First, do I check my coats? Even my mom, I'm like, sometimes my mom will come visit us and I'm like, let's just go to the local little restaurant and like see how you do, you know? And I'll say, mom, you know, sit at the counter. And even just getting her accustomed with like, you don't have to sit at a table by yourself if that feels uncomfortable at a restaurant. Sit at the bar by yourself. Bring your favorite book. Bring your favorite magazine, right? Like, make yourself comfortable. So if it's an event and you do get overwhelmed by the amount of new people in a room where you don't know how to strum up conversation, I would say, come up with what I call your trademark statement, which is not your elevator pitch, but it's who you are, what you do, and why you're in the room. Get really comfortable with whatever that is as your trademark statement. Get to the event early and make at least one anchor connection at the bar or, you know, at a table or a silent auction, whatever the event has or is. But don't get there late, because then other people have made connections that you feel like you can't fit into. So get there early and find what's comfortable for you. If that's a beverage, if that's asking for a plus one, if that's knowing that a plus one's going to meet you so that you're not going to be alone the whole time. This is a good question. It's not one that I've really given a lot of thought to before, but this is what I'm hearing from people often when they don't feel comfortable on their own in public spaces.
It's great advice. So you have your hands in a lot of different places. Your brain seems like it's always just full of ideas. Do you get bored often and keep on adding on to your plate? Or is there a point where you're like, okay, I have done all I can do in this one thing, and I'm going to close that door and open a new one? Like, how do you decide when you make your next move? Or is it all just additive?
I think it's all additive. But what I've also learned is that I'm often afraid, I think, of letting go of some things that I enjoy and that I've proven to do well. But you do have to let go of some things to make room for others. So in working backwards, and kind of started our conversation saying maybe we'll do the interview backwards. So like the way in which I now work backwards is, what are those things that I probably should let go of? I've proven myself in, I've gotten to like as high as I need to be or want to be or could be or should be. And should I step away from it because it no longer serves me? Maybe. But I've also recognized, as I say, that I don't want to always step away from things because I might really like that industry. And I'm like, but I really like it. I don't want to not be in XYZ industry. But maybe I don't need to be the same person that I was in an industry before. And that is then how I decide like where I instead advise, right? So how do I scale back my time, but still kind of satisfy my curiosity or my interest in that particular industry? And that's what I'm doing a lot of now.
Speaking of going backwards, when you think about yourself now and everything you've accomplished, and you flash back to you as a child, paint that picture for us.
Lauren always wanted to be successful. I felt like the little engine that could often. I loved the Jetsons as a child. Like, I believed that that was really going to be the future.
Where is the getting ready portal? Why can't we walk through and be ready? Where is that?
It's coming. Okay, it's coming.
I'm still waiting.
But I always was into like what was next. I always was resourceful. I feel as though the expectations of me were always so high. And I say this affectionately, but I know that it irks my father. I feel as though, you know, maybe my parents were designed to have more children that they divided their expectations against and across. Whereas I feel like I was expected to like do and create what three siblings that I never had could have also contributed towards doing. And that increased expectation at a very young age set me up to be really comfortable with what was required to get ahead as a Black woman. It was always required to have to do more. But I grew up with parents that gave me weekend homework and personal extra credit. And I don't know if you remember these little books that you could buy and like the little stickers in the back of the book when you completed and you'd like wet the sticker and then you'd like put the sticker in the book and all that kind of stuff. That's how I grew up. It was like, well, do you want extra points to go to the blah, blah, blah with your parents? I was like, but I don't need extra points. I'm doing good at school. Well, you need extra points at home. So I just think this has always been how I'm conditioned, is the bar is going to be higher and needed to raise it. And I always wanted to make money because I grew up with my parents being very honest with me about how they grew up in segregated times and the racism that they were both subjected to and drinking out of colored Negro labeled water fountains and riding the back of the bus and all of these things that when I would hear these stories, they seemed solvable with money, right? Money and power. and influence, right? You don't always have to have money, power, influence to change perspective or money. And so those are the things that I always wanted. And I think I was raised in a way that these conversations were ones that were always had. You know, I was always acutely aware of the value and the cost of money, whether that was my dad saying, get to school on time. Do you know all the money I'm paying for the school? And my dad would be like, school's expensive. He'd be like, back in the day, I went to Dalton. I was the only Black kid in New York City at Dalton in the 80s when first program on 91st Street had nursery school. They didn't even have anymore. And I think it was like 12 or 13,000 men. And I'm from 85. So it's like 88, 89. And my dad, whatever the number is, he's like, this school is $12,392. You better get out of this house sometime. So just like, I've always heard about,
I kind of love your dad.
I mean, and my mom, bless her heart, she was there like, it's like such an interesting thing. My mom's like a former model who, you know, is in Air Force, grew up with my grandparents in the Air Force, but then my mom loved to sew. So it's like, my dad's giving me this. And then my mom is like giving me the graceful side because she would go to Woolworths where I grew up, 86 and 3rd. It's now a Banana Republic, I think still. It used to be a Woolworths when I was a little girl, and we would go there and get the McCall and the Vogue patterns. And my mom would like sew my clothes on her Singer sewing machine. And then she'd be like, I'll do you something even better. I'll make them reversible. And so like, I got my dad on one side and then my mom on the other side. I'm like, I don't want these reversible clothes, please. No, like no more elastic bands.
But that is how you ended up at FIT, I bet.
I mean, it was what I was exposed to, right? So it was that. It was my mom then going into media and working at Essence Magazine and championing the stories of Black women. It was my dad being in finance. It was me being obsessed with real estate. It was watching my parents create first generation success for themselves at that time, where we were in spaces and places where we were often the only ones. It's all of it. I mean, it's my entire life's experience. It's having a father from Alexandria, Louisiana, who grew up in South Central LA, and a mom who grew up in England and was an Air Force baby, who was then later raised in Northern California on Travis Air Force Base and then eventually off the Air Force Base, that each have their perspective of life, money, success, career. But also, I've always felt like a fish out of water. My parents met in California. My family till this day is entirely in California. And I have always been seen in my family as Lauren, New Yorker. Oh, that's my cousin from New York. We're the only ones that were in New York at this pace with these goals, with a certain vision and like a drumbeat for where we wanted to go or where I wanted to go. And I also had, I think, very different examples of what success could be like for me when I grow up as a little Black girl, right? People would ask me, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I used to say, I want to do mortgage-backed acquisitions just like my dad, because that's what he was doing. That's what I saw. And that's what I thought was cool. And all I wanted to do was have a briefcase and hop on the Amtrak to DC to have power meetings like he was. Or I wanted to work red carpets and do PR like my mom back in the day when she ran PR for Essence. And before the Essence Music Festival of Culture, there was the Essence Awards and what used to be the Paramount Theater, which is now what, the Madison Square Garden Theater. So just all of these experiences were unique. In the 80s, in the 90s, even in the early 2000s, you didn't have a lot of people of color in these spaces. And so maybe it was a false sense of confidence in some way, like prematurely, to just believe that I belonged there. But I've always believed that I've belonged, not in a arrogant way, not in anything else, but just in a, you and I are equal. Like we're equal. I'm here. I went to the same schools. I took the same classes. I deserve to be here. We might not have the same things. That's okay. But I've always been very clear on my value.
I love that. And I would imagine you are imparting that confidence to your kids too.
I am.
Are you giving them extra credit? Did any of that get carried down? Just curious.
Yeah, but my version of extra credit has been disrupted a little bit. And it's forward thinking and it's a little Yeah, it's actually very respectfully disruptive, and I'm happy to share it. My pay it forward motivation for my kids, specifically with college, is mommy has college money saved. If it needs to be used to send them to college, awesome, it's there for them. If they, on their own merit, academic merit or sports or anything else, get scholarships or anything else as a result of who they are in the world and their acumen, then college money is their money. They get to decide how it gets spent.
Oh, damn. That's a good one. Lauren, what's next? What's on your bucket list?
My bucket list is my entire family. Well, I don't say entire family. Let me be clear because I might have some family that will hear this episode. Like, we going to Africa? Not my whole family. My immediate family. Maybe I'll take the whole family somewhere else. But my immediate family, my dream, my bucket list dream is Maasai Mara in Kenya and like safari all over Africa. But like dope safari experience.
Yes, I can picture it. Amazing. All right. Last question. How do you ultimately want to leave your mark? Like there's one headline about you. What does it say?
Ooh, gosh. I'm going to put it out there. It's bold moves towards a billion.
Amazing.
And I don't even know exactly what that means. Everyone can interpret that on their own, right? Like take that and run with it.
We're running with it. I think it's great. I mean, listen, I admire your hustle and I admire your vision. You're just like doing it your way. And you're so incredibly dedicated to the stuff that you believe in and want to support. And I think it's fabulous. So thanks for coming on Leave Your Mark. You're certainly leaving your mark.
Thank you. Thank you. I so appreciate this opportunity. I know your podcast is one that many power players listen to. You've had an incredible career yourself. I know we were connected through our mutual friend, Felita Harris, who I love dearly and think the world of. So I'm excited for you and I to spend more time together. Come visit us in Puerto Rico. We'll do more podcasts. We'll make it longer. We'll dig into other things.
I love Puerto Rico. That is a definite.
Come visit us anytime and leave your mark.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.